Joy, 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 ever new, joy, joy.
How did you get your name, Silent Lady?
How did I get my name? Well, Swamiji, early on in the time when Ananda was beginning and we were having more than just the people who were kind of a little crazy with us, we were beginning to understand, you know, what it meant to be on a spiritual path. And so I think Swamiji began to notice that there was something different than what we had been before. And one evening, I remember that we were having just a general meeting. It wasn't really anything terribly, terribly spiritual, but that was nice. It was a nice meeting. And at one point or another, he said, "You know, it would be really nice if we could have take on the names of some of our." I don't remember the details, but he said it would be very nice if we could have names that were Sanskrit names and that fit in with what we're doing here. So, yes, lots of people thought that was quite nice, and he gave one to Jaya right away, I think it was. Satya was another one. And so a number of people asked him for a spiritual name. And it wasn't long after that we had a Kriya initiation, I don't know, a few days, a week or something like that. And so, of course, we go up to the altar and we go to the minister, in this case, who was Swamiji, and, you know, he blessed us. And just as he was finishing that, he took me to the side and said, "Take the name of Sadhana Devi." That was how I got my name.
Wow, that's dramatic.
Yeah.
What year was that?
You know, Jaya? 69.
Okay.
Oh. Yeah.
So when did you come to Ananda?
68. No, wait a minute. I think it was 68, but I'm not
69.
Sure. It was 69.
Okay.
Hmm. Well, actually, we'll have to do a little adjustments here. Okay, but it's not terribly important.
Great.
Well, tell me about just your early life, your upbringing, what it was like.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I was born in California, along with my entire family of generations, I'm not sure what. But we lived in this the Central Valley, which is the sort of the big fruit bowl, they say sometimes, and things like that. And it's very agricultural, and we lived on a farm, our family did. So did the grandparents. They were very close by on their farm, and all around wherever we lived was probably our relations, and we were in one part of the state as the agricultural part. And so, yes, everybody in our family was in agriculture just about anyway. And we lived in the country, and my dad had a big farm, or he always called it a ranch. I never have figured out what's the right one, but he called it a ranch. And one reason why, I suppose, was that it wasn't just one crop. So he had vineyards. He had a lot of vineyards. And then in the summertime, when you needed to have what's called a cover crop, he did that as well. And he was not the only person working on his farm of 200-300 acres. He always hired people, of course, to work with him. And one of the types of people who came very, very often were people who were migrant workers from Mexico. Mm-hmm. I grew up knowing migrant workers from the time I was very young. They worked on our farm. Very often I would go out, my dad would let me come out and work out there too, and I would see a car sitting there right beside where we were working, and it was full of little kids. It was the family of whoever was working there, and that's what they would do when they were not working or when their kids were so small that they were concerned, of course, they would get lost. And so that was how I met people like that. They weren't just your average middle-class person. These were people who were actually very poor, but they were also extremely industrious, and they would sort of turn up out of nowhere, and they would be looking for work. And so I got to know a number of people like that. In fact, my dad had a particular guy who worked for him all the time. He was the hired man, he was called. And he, that man, had two sons that he brought with him pretty much all the time. Whenever school was, well, whenever they didn't have to go to school, that's how it worked, I think. And my dad actually let me work with them some of the time, which I thought was a lot of fun. And so we would do that, and we just worked whenever we could. When we didn't, they didn't have to go back to school. I mean, I didn't have to go back to school either, but it was a little bit more difficult for them. And that was how I got to know somebody who spoke another language all the time, practically, who also could speak English, but no, it wasn't quite like the one they were used to. And it's all a whole different kind of culture than the sort of things that just your regular middle-class kid, how they're brought up and how they do things. Mm-hmm. And we had a school, a normal public school that was about 2 miles away. And so that was the school I went to, too. There were many kids there that were from migrant workers very often. There also, it was a very diverse kind of area, as a matter of fact. It wasn't just people from Mexico. I had a number of kids who were of Japanese descent. Some of them were, at least one or two of them I know of, were born in that concentration camp you hear about sometimes from the after the Second World War or in during the war. Ooh, I think back on that, it's really pretty scary. But anyway, there was one girl that was my age or 1 year younger or something like that, and I read about her not very long ago. She was born in that concentration camp, and she is now in politics herself. She's a, forgot what we call her, but yeah. So people like that were born somewhere else. They came to America some way. And they went on in their life, and it changed things. Lots of things changed in their life. But that's how they see the world now, is from that perspective. Very different from what I had known. But thinking back on that, to me, that's a really interesting background to have or to be part of. And I do remember that we even had... Our school has so much diversity that there was even a family that had moved there while I was still going to school. They were from Samoa of all places. And sure enough, yeah, they had a family of, I don't know, 5 or 6 people in their family. Something like that. It was such an unusual kind of people that they had. But anyway, it was all very interesting. We all had lots of different people that we knew, and people were migrating as well. And some of them were literally migrant workers, but many of them also were people who lived in the town and they worked there or things like, maybe they then decided to migrate somewhere else, but not. Mm-hmm. It wasn't farm work. And so many of the people I knew were from somewhere else.
Yeah.
Hardly ever from where I was from.
Thanks.
In the midst of all that, did you have any early experiences of spirituality? Was your family that way, or how did that happen?
Yeah my mother's side of the family were Catholic. Mm-hmm. And so we all went to Catholic church. My father's side of the family were not. And they didn't go to church, including he didn't go to church unless my mother was really determined to get him to go on that day, which was usually one of the holidays, you know, Easter. He was not allowed out of the house, I don't think. So that was my background for a while, was, you know, the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in that, and as time went by, I had less and less enthusiasm for it, as you probably hear from lots of people. Even some of those people that who were working in our farm, some of them went to the Catholic Church also, you know. And it was, looking back on it, I think how nice that was, that I had so many people that I knew that were from a religion that, to me, didn't really say anything to me either. And it was nice to be in an environment with other people in the same, who had a similar outlook on that. Mm-hmm. And time went by, and eventually, no, I really wasn't interested in the Catholic Church. By this time, I had gone to high school, then I went to college, and then I finished college after studying social work. I thought, now that might be something interesting to do, much more than being a nurse or a school teacher. My family were full of school teachers, and I never liked the idea. But I did like the idea of social work, especially when I see all kinds of people around me who, you know, are living in a situation that's not easy for them, but very often they're able to move out of that and have something that is really for them and for lots of others. It's a real way to live. There were many kids that went to our school who now I have managed to look them up sometimes and find out what they're doing now, you know. And many of them have very successful businesses in that town and other towns not too far away. And so that's very encouraging to see that, because as they came to California, they were really, really poor. But by the time they had a couple of generations there, they were fine, and they did things that were really, really good. And so that made me feel much better than being a school teacher. Sorry, I hope was a school teacher who's watching this, but that was not what I wanted to do. And so when I went to college, I studied social work. The college I went to had that as a program. And so by the time I finished, I was pretty clear that that's what I was going to do. And I did. I got a job in my field, and I went to work there after school was out. And I lasted about 2 years, maximum of 2 years. It was so bureaucratic and so there wasn't any heart in it, you know. It made it really hard to go to work and to be with people who I probably would have known as friends just because they lived next door or I saw them at school or whatever, and yet they were treated as though, you know, they're not really, they don't have any ambition or they're not going to do anything about it. And that always annoyed me to a large extent. And so it wasn't long after I got that job that I decided to quit. I wanted to go to something that was, I don't know, seemed to be a better fit. So I had to just look around for things that I could do temporarily, you know, temporary work and that kind of thing. And I worked in restaurants once in a while and that stuff until I hoped I would find something that would be for me, and hopefully other people too, would be something that would be worthwhile. And hopefully help people that maybe were having troubles. Anything like that that we could do as a culture, I hope, would be a really nice thing, and it'd be a good way for everybody, not only people that are sort of the recipients of that or the people who are giving things. All of that, it should be a good thing. And so I was interested in that. So as I was looking around from here to there for temporary work once in a while, I ran into someone that we all know it's Benai Preston. I had known him in college, but not very well or not too often, but I saw him. And so I asked him, oh, gee, what do you do now? And he said, well, I'm up in the mountains now, and I'm caretaking some property for a man who wants to start a meditation retreat. Oh, I had tried that meditation one. I skipped over that, didn't I? I had tried meditation. When I was in one of my job offers, job seeking, I heard about the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, and that his group of people, not he exactly, that not that particular time, but the group of people that he had were going to come to University of California, Santa Cruz. I was living not too far from there, and I thought that was really interesting. And in fact, they had a program where you could come and you know, learn some things. And I had some friends, and we all decided we would go and find out what it was about, and see what we could do, if it made a difference for us. We did. We went to the UC Santa Cruz to this lecture and a little program, you know, short program, where we got our own, very own mantras, just the way Maharishi did his. And then, so we all went home after that. We got all the different things we needed to know, and we went home. And we went home in order to study and to practice our mantras. And so I did that, and all my friends quit. I guess it was too much for them, but no one else was interested but me. But I really was. I got really excited about it. I had heard about the Maharishi, and not much, but a little bit. And of course, the Beatles did it, and you could always look up this nice big picture of all of them. And I think Maharishi was in there somewhere, but I'm not sure. And so that made me look at all of everything I was doing in a really different perspective. And it was really nice to be able to hear this from Benai, because when he said he was caretaking the property, there was also, you know, the meditation retreat was being built. And that's where I said, gee, do you think I could go there? And he said, yes, but not right now. It was covered with snow. I don't think you're going to like it there then. But later on, we had some mutual friends from college. And later on, I ran into one or two of them, and I learned that they, too, were thinking to go up there to the meditation retreat that was being put together. It wasn't yet a meditation retreat. And that's what brought me there. I knew that if I could go there, especially already having people of like mind with me, you know, they weren't the kind of people who were going to tell me that was a stupid thing to do or any of that. We all went up there, and we were a group of people together. And to me, that was a completely different environment. I mean, probably is a different environment, but much more than what I was working in and how I was trying to live, you know, all that. I really was happy to be able to be in that environment. I was there in May of that year, and I met Jaya probably a couple of days after I got there. I don't remember, but yeah. And ever since then, here's where we are, right here at Ananda Village. And it's been really, really helpful for me and lots of other people as well, how we can not only make friends, but make friends that are people of like mind, and how we can not only be friends, but we can add to what people already are doing. You know, what do we do that makes our life more expansive? What do we do to make our life a place or a thing that we can do to help others? All kinds of things, as we know, are there. And so for me, That was the important thing. All the other things in life, well, they were nice, and, you know, it's okay. It's kind of fun to go shopping now and then, but nothing compares to being in a community of like-minded people and to find out that they were something I was already looking for and go there. There weren't very many people there, of course, not when we first started. Probably, 10, maybe, people that were working there. But, yes, they were, almost everybody was of like mind.
Was Swami Kriyananda there at the time?
Let's see. I think he was there for just a few days when I was there. And then, but later on, I think he probably went back to San Francisco for a while to take care of things. But I do remember that he used to show us slides of his trips to India. And he would just have a little evening, you know, get together in the temple, and we would all sit and watch those slides. They were really amazing. And he also very often sat with us at mealtime, not always, but often. And so we all began to get to know him much better than, you know, if he had just been that man that was in charge or that sort of thing. You know.
What was he like in those days?
What was he like? Well, he was a bit different than what I was used to. He was more willing to sit and talk with you, I have a feeling, than a lot of people are. He was the man that was in charge, and someone would come and sit beside him, I think, at the lunch or dinner or whatever, and he was quite happy to have a conversation with people, which is not the way it always is. Some people are not like that.
Those of us that came later, it was pretty clear that who Swami was and that he was the force behind it all, but my impression is that that wasn't always obvious in the early days.
Quite. Sometimes that was just chaos, real chaos. Because we didn't have what we call Ananda Village now, which was a farm. And all we had at first was the meditation retreat. And people would come and see our farm, and they could have been people from any kind of walk of life. Sometimes they just didn't have any idea that they would be asked to help out what they were doing, or maybe they should be paying some rent or paying for to stay. A lot of them just were like, "What? You're going to ask me to do something like that?" I remember one guy, I don't remember, I actually heard this, but I heard it indirectly as well. We were all working together, and mostly we were working at the time, we were fixing meals and cleaning up after that. And so this one particular guy was asked, could you come in and work in the kitchen here, especially on the cleaning up afterwards kind of thing? And he said, No, I meditate. I don't need to do that. He wasn't the only one who said things like that. Oh, dear.
So what were some of your early jobs or responsibilities?
Oh, right, yeah. Well, when I arrived there, I was expecting I might have to go back to San Francisco or wherever I happened to be staying. But I was okay. I asked if I could stay, and they said yes. So, okay. What I did was I tried to work in the kitchen if there was room. That is a problem. You don't get to just walk in there and, oh, yeah, okay, well, we'll take care of about 3 meals now. No problem. It was too small for more than about 2 or 3 people maximum. That's where I met Jaya. He came... I was in the kitchen doing something like, I don't know, washing dishes, and I turned to my right side or something, and I saw that the refrigerator was in there, and the door was open to the refrigerator, and then somebody got out and turned and closed the door. That was Jaya. He was busy making his breakfast or something, I don't know what. Anyway, but that was one of the ways that one of the jobs that I had right away. I think probably everybody ended up doing something helpful in the kitchen, because that was all. There weren't very many other jobs available, and everyone had to eat. So everybody tried to help out with the kitchen and the cleaning and all that kind of things like that.
So tell me about moving to the village and making teepees.
We, of course, after a while, began to become obvious that we weren't probably going to have a very good shelter if we didn't make something or buy something or what have you. Because, you know, pretty soon it's going to be snowing. Most people hadn't thought about it at all, I have a feeling. But some of us did. And I had this book, which someone, for some reason, had given me. It's called The Indian Teepee. And I read the book. I thought it was really interesting. And it was more than just talking about them, but it was, you know, a book, a how-to book, to get it all put together, where to put it, and how, you know, all kinds of things about it. Anyway, I thought it was interesting. Well, we were at this meeting when this came up to my mind, I guess it was, and people were saying, "Well, what are we gonna do for shelter? We've got to have something, and can we build things fast?" And somebody else wanted to just use those travel trailers that were popular back then. And I said, well, I could probably make a teepee because I just read this book. It's got all the instructions and everything. And a few people thought that was really exciting. So we kind of got together after a while. I don't know how many teepees we started with, but I do know that I eventually sewed 12 teepees. Mm-hmm. That's right. In a row. And then we put it all together. Now, sewing a teepee is not enough. You have to have something to hold the teepee up. Mm-hmm. And so we needed poles of some sort. And I think Jaya went up to the Forest Service and got a permit to cut some poles of the right diameter. And we could just take them away or whatever, pay for them or something. And we brought them home, I guess, before we stripped off the bark. And then we put them up, ready for the fabric to go around them. They looked really interesting to me, those just the pieces of, not the fabric, not the outdoor, but the frame. And we put up a bunch of them around Ananda Village, and so they could be cured, wood of the poles would have disintegrated or something. I'm not sure what, but we stripped off the bark and we put them up, and they cured out there in the sun. That got them started. We almost were ready to put all the fabric around and everything, but it was starting to look like maybe that's not going to work so well. One thing that happened was that we had used some sort of, what do they call that stuff? Well, anyway, it's a repellent, that's it. And it was supposedly going to make the fabric repellent to whatever. And then, you know, it wouldn't be a problem especially during the rainy season. And so we did put one up like that. I don't think I was actually right there, but one did get put up with that instead of the ones that we had made. And it wasn't long after that. I think we might have had a rainstorm, but whatever it was, the fabric now was disintegrating. That's just what it did. It had nothing to do with how we did it or any of that. It just was sitting there, disintegrating. Well, I don't even know if the rain came or not. I think it was the sun that actually damaged it. And I remember walking up the hill towards where my teepee had been, and there wasn't really a teepee left there. There were the poles, but the rest of the fabric was shredded. It looked like It looked like, sometimes, you know, you see lots of frilly things that look like little flags around. Well, that was kind of what they looked like. And so that was the end of the idea of that stuff that we put on. Because we were all concerned about, well, what do you do when it starts raining all the time? Nobody had a good answer for that one. But eventually, we actually did end up with something that worked. It was Jyotish. Everybody wanted their place to look pretty and not be, having a bunch of stuff on it that was to keep, would hopefully keep it going. And how would you be able to be in a teepee like that when it's raining? It's going to soak the fabric, and that would just be so terrible. And Jyotish came up with a brilliant idea. He took a big sheet of plastic sheeting, not a piece of stuff, but he spread it out, I guess, on the ground, and he used something like a rock to put in the center of this, and then he took a small rope and went around that to keep it from all coming apart, and then... This doesn't go on forever, I promise. Then he pulled it up to the top of the teepee where all those poles go together. Mm-hmm. And that was what got it pretty much to a spot where it was not going to fall. Mm-hmm. He took all the rest of the sheeting and didn't have to be every single one of the poles, but on most of them, he took a staple gun, I think, and he attached the plastic sheeting to the poles as it went around, like that. And rains came, the water came down on the backside of the plastic, and it ran down in between the plastic and the fabric. So the fabric sat there being soaked, but the water didn't actually go into the teepee itself. Mm-hmm. That was the genius part. I don't know if I've ever seen anything like that or read it in a book or any of that, but that's how it got going, because most of us started off with the wet teepees. That was pretty discouraging. But, yeah, I got them to work.
Where did you get the fabric? Was it canvas?
Yes, so the fabric is a sail fabric for making sails. And so you had to mostly go to somewhere where there were boats, like San Francisco. Mm-hmm. But you can also get... I think you could buy the fabric from a place that makes tents also.
And then when you sewed it together, did you use big needles or what?
No, we did it with sewing machines.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
I know, it sounds really amazing, but it takes two people to make something with the sewing machine, because one person has to sit on the end that's got holding up the new stuff going through the sewing machine.
Yeah.
And someone has to sit on the other side, sort of pulling the fabric through, because it would just bunch up and make a big mess and not work. I ended up doing, I think it was 12 or 14 of them, but I did not do all of them by myself.
I've heard people say that it's their favorite housing that they've ever lived in. So that's yeah. Great. All right, now I want to know your version of the story about being asked to go to Rhode Island and being asked to go to India.
So Swamiji talked to Jaya first, I guess, and then he asked me to go and see him. Jaya had explained what he was doing, but he didn't really explain that Swami was going to ask me to come and talk to him about it. And at the time... we were kind of toward the end of our stint with the village office. That's what we did for, I don't know, a while, village management, that kind of thing. And I suppose maybe Swami realized that was happening, but he asked me to come and see him, and he told me about the place that Om Prakash and Prem Shanti were wanting to get started in Rhode Island. I thought that was kind of boring. But I tried to be polite. And Swami said, we really need somebody to go there. And actually, it's you that we need. We need you to go there. He said, now, I'm not going to ask you if you would like to do this. I'm going to ask you to do it. That was it. I was done. There was no way I was going to get out of that one. So I said, well, I have a job now outside of Ananda. And he said, oh, that's not worth it. So I went home and we talked and we finally said, well, okay, I guess we better get ready. We had a house that Jaya had built in it. When was it? 2 years before? 3 years? No, I mean, it wasn't an old house that was falling down or anything. So, okay, I guess we'll go to East Coast. I'd never been to Rhode Island, so I wasn't really interested in the East Coast in the first place, but we had to do something. And that's where we went.
How long were you there?
How long were we there? We were there, was it 2 years? 4 years. Oh my. Yeah, and we did do something that I felt was really worth it and really nice. There were people there that Om Prakash and Prem Shanti had already begun getting acquainted with. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, they wanted to take classes that we had, and you know. So we got to know a lot more people than three or four. Mm-hmm. And we lived there in the state of Rhode Island, but most of these people lived in the other states, north or east or whatever. And yeah, we did. We met all sorts of new people, and most of them were really nice. And so we stayed there for, you said 4 years?
3.5.
Yeah, 4.5, something.
3.5.
3.5, okay, yeah.
Did you ever get to like it?
Well... I definitely got tired of the snow.
California girl.
Yeah. After getting run off the road once or twice in the snow, I got a little nervous about driving in the snow. Mm-hmm. But anyway, nobody else seemed to be bothered by it. But yeah, anyway.
So how did India happen?
We were okay. So we were there in that. In toward the end of December that year, and Jaya at one point said, oh, I have this idea. Wouldn't it be fun now to go and see Swamiji in his new house in Gurgaon? And so we'd go for a little trip there. We haven't been there, and it would be really nice, wouldn't it? And we could take Prem Shanti and Om Prakash with us, and yeah, why don't we go and do that? So I thought that was kind of a good idea. And it doesn't snow there in Gurgaon or anything. So we got everything all together, and they weren't that excited about the idea of going, but they were sort of excited. So anyway, so we went. The four of us went together, and we got there and all that. That was the time when. He were kind of in the middle of a sentence. Swamiji said, we're growing a lot now, and more people are coming, and it's very nice, and we need Jaya and Sadhana Devi to come and move here and help out. And then after everyone else left in that group of people that were visiting Swamiji, Swamiji said, apologize to me for sending me to Rhode Island after he said, you know, I'm not asking you if you want to do that or if you would like to do this, I'm asking you to do it. So that he apologized for that.
It seems like you were always just very natural and very close around Swami, just very easy coming to the village and easy working, supporting the things that he wanted to get done.
Yeah.
Do you think you were part of his army in the past?
Who knows? Who knows? Yeah. It was nice being part of his army now, you know, and a lot of what happened with Swamiji, my experience was that he wasn't put on a pedestal. Well, some people wanted him to be on a pedestal, but most of the time he was not willing to be on a pedestal. Mm-hmm. And it became more and more natural for us to get acquainted with him, you know. And so that was one difference. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was one of the things that you can see about Swamiji. Very often he would maybe step down from the pedestal that somebody had put him on, you know, mm-hmm. and just be a normal person. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's nice.